It's my pleasure and privilege to introduce tonight Paul Bieker.
Everybody, you know, I've had a couple of sponsors in this journey, and they both said that when you do this, you're just supposed to share, you know, what it was like, what it's like now, and how you got there, so I try to stick to that. Yeah, I hope I don't offend anybody. There are some outside substances that had a great deal to do with my alcoholism, but I will tell you this, that I am a true alcoholic. Given the choice of any other thing, I want my Irish whiskey and my Guinness first. I was born in 1950 in a place called County Cork, Ireland. My mother was about 16, and that just didn't happen in Southern Ireland. It's a rural place. And my dad died when I was two. I vaguely remember him. He had an automobile wreck. He was driving a truck for Guinness and Harps Company. He killed two American tourists. He also died himself. Apparently, he was a functioning alcoholic. I can't say that. I just know my dad drank a bit. You know, everything went pretty normal in Ireland. You know, I worked in the fields. I really enjoyed what I did. I helped my grandfather, and I learned how to lay stone, be a carpenter. At an early age, I knew that there was time to work and there was time to go to school. And then by the time I was eight, I knew that there was one other time, and that was time to spend time with my da in the taverns in Southern Ireland. And that was a great time for me. We played snooker and pool and billiards. I was able to have half a pint of porter. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's about half a pint of Guinness, but it's a little stronger alcohol content in Ireland and England. And I really enjoyed that. I don't know if I enjoyed the buzz of alcohol as I enjoyed being around men. You know, I was around my da, that's my granddad, he helped raise me. And right around the time I turned nine, I got involved with some real strong beliefs about what was going on in Ireland. Some very strong beliefs about what was going on in Southern Ireland. And so I began to, on my moped as well as on my bike, to deliver things. Weapons, munitions, money. And I got caught once by a constable, and then I got caught once by a British soldier and two constables. And I was brought home both times, and the weapons were seized. And at that time, my mother made my granddad promise to get a visa so that he could come to America and bring the family to America to seek what we call the American dream. Because at that time I had already had one cousin who was only 7 years older than I. He was on trial for a bombing in Belfast. And that cousin today is still in prison. And he was tried at age 15 or 16. He was found guilty. He's still in prison today. I have another cousin that just recently, who was 2 years older than I, when he was involved, he was running guns. He was sentenced to juvenile prison to be continued on in adult prison. He was only released 3 years ago. You know, but I had some very strong beliefs, you know. I won't go into that, but I just had some very strong beliefs about my heritage. As far as I was concerned, it was England out of Ireland, and it was forever. That's what I wanted. So in doing that, my granddad came here, and he, believe it or not, he found a really good job in a place called Birmingham, Alabama. And he worked for about 9 months, and we all got visas, and we came here. And I was 11 by that time, almost 12. And we came in through New York, and that's a pretty good place. I mean, I thought that's cool, that's groovy. You know, I didn't find much different thing about it. I stayed with my grandfather's brother, who had been in this country for 7 years, and they were all had brogues. They all spoke the same way I spoke, which was great. There's a great difference in the way I speak now and pronounce things than there was when I first got here. And shortly after, about 3 or 4 weeks, my grandfather bought some land in a place called Birmingham, Alabama. And he had a regular job, and so we moved to a place called Birmingham, Alabama. And when I got there, I heard a lot of stuff like, "Man, you sure talk funny." You know? And I do remember one of the most embarrassing moments in my life is I went to the little boys' room in the school, and, you know, they didn't really have a lot of modern things there. Of course, they did have your regular urinal in Ireland, but there was a trough thing that almost looked like something you'd feed livestock out of. You go up and you push the pedal, and I thought you washed your hands in it, you know? But that's not what it was for. It was like a round thing with a big mushroom coming out of it, and water came out of it, but that's not what you know? So I began to go over and get stuff, started washing my hands in it after recess, and then they went back and told the teacher. I was chastised for that, and I won't ever in my life forget it. And they didn't let me forget it either. you know. But I was pretty good in school, and things rocked on, and I went to parochial school. And that worked out pretty well. So I told the nun a few things, and I did it over and over until at which time they threw me out of the parochial school. And that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, because I was sexually molested during the 4 years I was at that parochial school. And I just thought that was part of the Catholic way by the time that had happened. You know, I'm not ashamed to say that today. I didn't make those choices. I didn't have anything to do with that. You know, and later on I'll talk about how I got through that and what I've done in my step process to forgive that man. So I started going to regular high school. By that time, I went to 1 year of regular grammar school, and then I went to high school, and it was on then, you know. But during this whole period of time, I will tell you that my mom tried to establish a wholesome life for us. Dated several men, got married 3 times. All of those 3 men she married slapped her around, beat her up, and they drank heavily. By the time I was 14, my mom met a cat named Phil, who was a biker, who I thought was just the grooviest. I mean, he was cool. That man adopted us. That's the reason my name, my real name is Kelly, but now it's Beaker, because that man adopted all of us kids. I have 2 half-sisters. Both of them have different fathers. And Phil was great. He was great to all his kids. And that's really when I started to have any sort of male mentor in my life besides my grandfather. You know, my grandfather believed in working 6 days a week, 7 if you ever want to get ahead. He believed in drinking a Guinness a night, a 6-pack of Guinness a night, because that was what he deserved, because he was a working man. And he ruled our household with an iron fist. And when my mom met Phil, he liked Phil, and he thought it was time for him to step out of the picture. At that time, my grandfather moved into his own home, didn't no longer live with us, and Phil started being the dad around the house. You know, and I never had any other father figure besides that and my granddad. Well, when Phil moved in, he was a worldling. You know, he worked every day. He worked very hard. He made very good money. Treated my mom like a queen, you know. Every Friday, he brought my mom flowers. Every single Friday that man would live and was with my mother, he bought her flowers. He was great to my mom. He never, never did he slap her around. He told me I was to never hit a woman, because if I did, I'd never be a man. And that was bullshit, but that's what childish men did that wouldn't even stand up in their own fight and usually couldn't fight their way out of a wet paper bag. I won't ever forget it. I've never hit a woman. You know, he also did some other things that I won't go into deeply, but he dealt marijuana, you know, and some other stuff, you know, that are outside issues called meth. And I remember when I broke that man's heart one day when I stole some meth from him. You know, I broke his heart. And he told me that. And here was this guy who was 6'9", he weighed about 280, you know, and when he caught me, I just knew I was going to get my ass whooped. He said, I'm going to whoop your ass. You already done the damage. He said, you just broke my heart. He said, stuff's not good for you. I try to make a living around here. You're out there giving it to your kid. You got your kid friends, and you're going to go to jail. And he said, more than that, you broke my heart. He said, I won't give you a chance to work it off. You know, and so I worked at him after I got out of school. I'd worked with him in his welding plant, and then I worked at Shoney's Big Boy, and I worked for my granddad on the weekends. And I paid him back. And then when I gave him the money, he gave me back the money and said, it's done now. At least you worked it off. Don't ever steal from your family again. He said, real men don't steal from their family. So, but that's where my addiction took me. You know, my addiction in later years, I stole from my family in one way or another. Either time or money or days dropped off the face of the earth. In 1968, right after school, I was real good in high school. I graduated early, 1 year early. I thought I would like to go to college, and we just didn't have that kind of money. So I thought I'd go to Jeff State, which is in Birmingham, Alabama. It's a junior college. And so I got a job at Huck's Box Factory, working the graveyard shift. I was a carpenter in the daytime. When my grandfather could put up with me, it's pretty headstrong. And so I learned how to trim, run trim in high-end houses, and work in my grandfather's cabin shop. And I was making boxes at Huck's Box Factory in the graveyard shift. And I decided I wanted enough money to get me into college. I'd just go ahead and rather go to University of Alabama, Birmingham. So if I just wait, hold off and go to Jeff State, so a little dope, I could get into UAB. And chasing my dream, which was photography and art. And so I did that, and in doing that, apparently I sold to the wrong people. You know, because I used to drink a lot when I did everything. I liked to drink a lot. I liked drinking. It was fun. You know, pasta pint ale, a yard of beer, and that's what I liked. And so I was sitting at the phone line down from my house, because I was real smart. I was never going to use my house phone for anything. It's this long-haired cap, hair about down in here, blonde, look hippie, told I'm a priest, peace signs all over, and I'm on the phone. He goes, Paul Beecher? I said, yeah, man, what do you need? He goes, you Paul? I said, yeah, man, you need something? He goes, yeah, can I have your right hand, please? And I had him, he turned over there, and he handcuffed me. He said, you're under arrest. I said, you gotta be kidding me, man. And so we pull up to my little apartment, and there was six or seven unmarked cars in the yard, in the driveway. Now, I lived in a house with some Koreans. They rented me an apartment upstairs. There were family of little Koreans downstairs. They thought I was the greatest guy. And I didn't have a bunch of people running in and out. And I walk upstairs, and there's like 11 cops up there. There's three of them in uniforms, and the rest of them, and they scared the shit out of me. And they, you know, what I had done is I had sold marijuana in large quantities. So I'm going to very large to a cop five times. I had sold one cop 100 Quaaludes and another cop 600 Black Beauties. And I was 17 years old. So I went to jail. My mom couldn't afford to bail me out. By the time my stepdad got up enough money to bail me out, I went to court. And they offered me a deal. They said if I'd go to the military, they'd drop everything and give me a waiver. And no charges would ever be filed. So I went in the military on the impression that I was my mom's only child and I would probably never see active duty in country. And first place I served in the military was in Vietnam. During Vietnam, I got to Vietnam in 1969. The latter part of 68, and then after about 6 weeks. By the time I hit Vietnam, it was in Saigon, was where I first flew in. It was 69. And, you know, I had 4 days off before I had to report. And I learned everything I could learn about Vietnam, in city, in Saigon, having fun, getting drunk, and doing outside substances in 4 days. And it was on. I was finally stationed in a place called Pleiku Fire Base. And I was a door gunner on a thing called an assault and escort ship. And, that was a lot of fun. I mean, there ain't nothing like, you know, being on a helicopter in the air and smoke going off. You're high as hell. You're getting drunk the night before. You're sweating. You're hanging out on the blades, shooting as many rounds off as you can with an M50. I mean, that's a lot of fun. And so I finally made it through that tour, and I came home because all I had to do was a year. And in those days, you didn't have to do 3 years. If you went in under what they call a classified waiver prosecution, all you had to do was a year. You had to do a year in service, and you had to do your tech school and your basic training, so it really added up to about 16 months for me. I got out and started dating someone, and I was hanging out, and I shipped over a bunch of outside substances. I had to ship a potload of money. I'd saved all my money, and I ended up in San Francisco, California, and I was living in the Haight-Ashbury area, and you know, I met this woman, and she was all the rage, man. I thought this was it. This was the one, you know. And one day I'm laying back after a night of drinking and drugging, and we had gone to see Little Feat and the Grateful Dead at Winterland Theater. And it was a great show, I tell you, folks. And I had a hangover, and she said, where's my sundress? I said, well, you got to adapt and overcome, girl. She goes, what does that mean? I said, I've washed it. It's hanging on a hanger inside the closet. And she opened the closet door, and there were the uniforms we had never talked about. And she said, were you a soldier? I said, yeah, I don't want to talk about it. She said, did you go to Vietnam? I said, yeah, I don't want to talk about it. She said, can I ask you one more question? You know, she looked bad at my eyes. She was beautiful and blonde, one of those California girls. Here I am, just an old country boy from Alabama. I said, sure, one question. After that, we don't talk about it. And she said, did I have anything to do with the innocent killing and maiming of the women and children in Vietnam? After that point, I threw what they call a K-bar at her. Anybody ever seen Rambo? It's one of the very large military issue knives that's stuck in a closet door like that. And I proceeded to throw her out in the hallway naked as a jaybird. But I didn't hit her. Because, you know, pops that don't ever hit women. So, at that time, the house detectives arrived. I was the Ritz-Carlton in Haight-Ashbury, about two blocks from Winterland Theater. And some regular detectives arrived and some uniformed police officers. And they heard me out and they heard her out, what they could make out of her babbling and screaming, because she, you know, she's pretty upset. I didn't understand why I didn't hit her. But, you know, they said, look, boy, there's no room for war heroes here in San Francisco. The war's over for you. You need to cut your damn hair and get a job. And that's exactly what I did. The very next day, I went to the recruiter station. I told them I wanted my E-5 back. I wanted to go a guaranteed duty detail in Vietnam. I wanted to go to jump school. I wanted to be a ranger. And I wanted it guaranteed that I could spend my entire 3 years active duty in country in Vietnam. Because that's what they told me to do, was get a job. And that's, after doing all the dope I did, that's the only thing I could remember that I was good at. Because I was pretty damn good at that. Because I came out alive. So they did that. They sent me to jump school in Fort Bragg, where I drank my ass off, had a good time. They waived my basic training. Then I went to sea school in Coronado Sub Base to train with the SEALs, learn how to use underwater explosives, also learn how to dive and work with the Navy SEALs on Special Task Force called Long Distance Alert Recon. And then I was stationed in a place called Fubai with the 1st to the 9th Walking Dead Marine Unit. We all worked together. And shortly after that, sometime in 1971, I was in a firefight, which is, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of smoke going on. A lieutenant got hurt. I tried to carry him. I pulled the tripwire. That was attached to a ground anti-personnel explosive detonating device. Now I have an artificial hip, 2 steel rods in both my legs, and 2 steel plates in my head. I came back home. When I got back home, I found out my grandfather had a shit pot load of money for me to go to school with, and the VA was going to pay for me to go to school, so I proceeded to sell dope, go to school, and have one hell of a good time in a place called San Francisco, in the city, San Francisco City Berkeley College, which is now a university, and it's pretty happening, man. And then when I finished college there, which was a 4-year degree, it took about 6.5 years to blow that $60,000 for school, and I could receive that money as long as I was in school. I did real well in it. When I got out, they said I could be a teacher. So I tried a couple of teaching jobs in private schools in California, and I found myself attached to all the 18-year-old women. I always wanted to marry one of them. That was my biggest problem. I would fall in love with just one, you know. Just one, you know. And then I wanted to marry, and they were all hush-hush. We think you should resign. So then from there, I went to a place called Rochester, New York, and tried to work at a school called Oakwood in Poughkeepsie, New York. And everything was cool, you know. I finally decided that I dated someone about my age. She was 23, but she was not going to Oakwood. And we went out one night riding my Harley, and the dean came over to tell me he needed somebody to watch the activity period during the play because one of the people in the language department couldn't make it, and I needed to sit in on that, keep things at a minimum. So. Well, what he found was my door was open, so he just went in. He's going to leave a note on my table, and then when he walked in, he found a tri-beam, a bottle of Irish whiskey, some beers, some seeds, some stems, and some other miscellaneous outside stuff that led him to believe I probably did not need to be employed by that private prep school. So he asked me to resign once again. And at that time, I went to blow some more money. From there, I went to New Haven, Connecticut, and I couldn't get in Yale at first, so I decided I'd drink my way in SCANU, which is Southern Connecticut University, and I fit in pretty good. There's a lot of deadheads there, which that worked out real well for somebody that likes to drink a lot and sell outside substances and, you know, work. So. And then I got accepted into Yale, and that was pretty cool because those kids could, the undergrads, now I was in the master's program, but the undergraduates could spend a lot of money because their parents had a lot of money. And so once again, you know, working as a carpenter in the summer months, I finally, in 3 years, and after turning in a dissertation 142 days late, because I always like to procrastinate because I'm a drunk, I made it out of there, and I moved to Houston, Texas, became an iron worker. And I loved that. That was great. I had found what I was supposed to do, connected 20 stories up, 15 stories up. You know, it was great. It's the craziest thing I've ever done. I loved it. When I got sober, I found I was scared of heights. I get on a roof. And that's the truth. You know, I get on a roof, I work a rotunda inside a building 20 scaffoldings up, 28 bucks, but 28 foot bucks up. But you get me outside where the sky starts floating around, the clouds start moving, I'm looking up, and I don't want to do that. But that's what happened when I got sober. So that's kind of how it was, you know. I mean, I just, you know, I was a true alcoholic from the start. I don't know if my grandfather was a functioning alcoholic. I know that he drank porter and Guinness till the day he died, and I also know he smoked a pipe. I know that my stepdad, Phil, who I had a good relationship with, was a hard worker, and I know that he drank at least 12-pack of Heineken every night, but he went to work every day. But somewhere along those lines, somewhere in Houston, Texas, I found a lot of other things to go with my alcohol. And I'm not going to go into the drug thing because it's Alcoholics Anonymous, but for anybody out there that can read through the lines, there's a couple of artists out there I really like music that tells you about how it was. One of the lines is, I spent nights with lighters and knives when jumping off my roof was only two flights. That's the kind of desperation I was in, you know. But I didn't think it was that bad. You know, another line is about how I got here. It's a song by Nickelback. It's called, This Is How You People Show Me Who I Am. And that's how I got here. I finally realized I'm an alcoholic. And that's just one of the symptoms of my disease. It's just one symptom of my disease. And the fear that I had when I realized that I was an alcoholic, it's a line by Mighty Joe Plum, a band, and it says, have you ever felt like jumping 10,000 stories and be fearful that when you hit the pavement, it won't kill you? Yeah, that's how fearful I was. Because I didn't trust none of you guys. I thought all of you were lying. Thought every one of you had your stuff together in a nice car and a nice job, had bags and bottles under your car, and you were selling to the other folks that roll up in here with beat up cars and shitty clothes on. And that's really what I thought, and that's not what I think today. You know, I know that I made a lot of changes. I will say this, I've had, since 1990, I've had 2 years sober. I've had 5 years, 11 months, 5 years, 7 months, and 21 days sober. Then after that relapse lasted about 15 days. It's not a relapse. I chose the journey. I knew about this disease. I could have stopped it. All I had to do was ask for help. And then I had 6 years, 1 month, and 29 days, almost to seven, and I decided to pick up for 6 days. And that was 4 years and a month ago or so. But this time when I came back, you know, I still had the same sponsor who died. He's been dead now for 2-3 years and 2 months, and when he was dying of leukemia, he told me I need to get another sponsor, and I told him I'm good. I'll be alright. I know what to do. You know, I've already been through all this picking up, putting down, that I'll be alright. And I came up here because they told me 2 years ago, August, I came up here because they told me I was dying of a thing called Hodgkin's lymphoma. It had reached my lymph nodes. It was in my testicular gland. It's in my prostate. It's all in my facial glands. And there probably wasn't anything they could do for me. And that's what they told me in Florida, where I was now residing. And so when they told me I was terminal, I just decided to roll and run. Got on my Harley and rode all of the United States. And then I got back home to check in with a house that I had purchased from a settlement and in a place called Ormond Beach. And there was a letter in there saying that if I would come up here, I could be one of 30 people to start an experimental program, okay, by the government, and the VA would pay for it. So I raced up here, and I got here in about 4 days. And I put my name on the list, and about 4 or 5 days later, they started an outpatient chemo and radiation treatment. Wherein I wasn't supposed to work, but I'm not drawing a disability. So for 2 years I tried to work, and for 2 years I was in and out of the hospital right here. I'd come in, I'd get a place with somebody that's in recovery, I'd be enjoying life, I'd go check in, I'd do my outpatient chemo, and they'd keep me. Well, battling that, they told me that they were going to have to stop that treatment because they found out I had Jenkins carcinoma, which is lung cancer. At that point, I took they gave me about 3 days to make my decision, and my decision was to eat a bunch of my depression medicine. I tried to kill myself. The result of that was about a 7-day coma, and I had to be dialyzed, had to put a port in me, you know, and I came to, and, you know, I guess that wasn't going to do it. So during that time, I met a man who I now know to be my grand sponsor, who had cancer. And he's not doing real well right now, but he told me that there was a reason for, a reason why I didn't die when I ate those 100 pills, and there was a reason I was supposed to be here, and I wasn't supposed to know it yet. And, you know, when I look at a man today, he can't even remember how many long talks we had about me having cancer. He doesn't even know that he helped me so much. But I have somebody in my life today. I have 3 sponsees, and one of them has cancer. He was diagnosed 11 days ago. All I know to do is tell him how to stay sober and not give up and let him treat him for his cancer. And maybe that's one of those reasons why I'm here. But I do know I'm only here because of you guys. The changes I've made in my life and the way I look and the way I dress, there's nothing compared to the changes I've made in my heart. The darkness that was inside my heart and my head was far beyond anybody's imagination, and I wasn't going to change it or let it go. I wasn't ever going to forgive you if you did me wrong, but I've worked some steps with sponsor today, and I've done my 8-step list, and you know, I owe some amends to some people, and some of them financial, and I'm not financially able to do that yet, but I'm going to sit down and write some letters to those 6 people. I owe my little sister, she's my half-sister, amends. I made an ass of myself when I gave her away at her wedding. And when a friend of mine who finds people with given information finds her, I'm going to see if she'll see me and apologize to her. Because the kind of guy I was I couldn't imagine why my sister would be pissed off at me because I showed up to give her away with some broad that, you know, I'd known for 3 days. And excuse that language, that's just the way she was, and she didn't mind being called that. She was not dressed appropriately. I had leathers on. Instead of driving the car, I drove the bike. You know, I came in with a vest on with a patch of a motorcycle club. And had my tux there ready to give her away. And then I had guns on me, and I had to take those off. And her husband's parents saw all that stuff when I was changing clothes. And I couldn't understand why those folks couldn't just accept me the way I was. I was there to give my sister away. What's y'all's problem? You know, this is who I am. I will tell you this, that in 1992, and I'm very grateful for that, I had rode with a motorcycle club for 30-something years. They're very well known, and I'll leave it at that. But I had been making so many mistakes that they told me that they thought I had a problem. They didn't know what my problem was, but I needed to do something about it. I had made mistakes like being in Tennessee to deliver a U-Haul truck full of weapons for sale. And woke up the next morning telling them, I think they towed the truck. What do you mean? It's not where I parked it. Well, that's because I couldn't tell them I didn't remember where I parked it. I remember one time, and this was the straw that broke the camel's back, and this was after I was doing outside substances, which my motorcycle club does not put up with in the manner I was doing it. I drove from North Carolina back home with a bunch of money, and I decided to stop in Dalton, my bright idea to see this woman I hadn't seen in a long time, and I left the money there. The money was about $27,000. And I drove all the way to Kennesaw, pulled in the parking lot of our clubhouse, realized I did not have the money. And didn't say anything. Then pulled back out and drove back to Dalton. And there she was, because I was, you know, I was still using them, so she, you know, just somebody I knew. I wouldn't let anybody in my life for more than 2 or 3 days, because I was fucked up, I knew it. And she was passed out, so I just eased in, picked the money up off the couch, wiped the sweat off my brow, and decided not to answer my cell phone on the way up there, on the way back till I got there. That was on Saturday. They had a meeting on Sunday, which we usually do for all patch members, and they said, you got a problem, Bird. We don't know what your problem is, but here's a card of a guy that might be able to help you. Because you got 90 days to get your shit together. We're going to take your patch and you owe us $2,000. You owe the club $2,000. We're going to take your bike. And so I'm going to tell every one of you, when I came in here, I did not come in here to stop drinking. I came in here to keep my patch and to keep my bike. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I knew what alcoholics were. Alcoholics drink vodka in the morning. All right, and they got DUIs. I had been educated in schools, colleges, and universities. I knew what an alcoholic was. Alcoholics drank vodka in the morning, and they got DUIs. I had never done either. To this day, I have never had a shot or a drink of vodka or a DUI. How, I don't know. But so I met this man named Sard. He started bringing me around here. He knew another guy I knew vaguely named Hoyt. I didn't know much about Hoyt. Turns out much later, the guy, and I didn't know this either, but the sponsor I have today, I found out about a year ago, his sponsor was Hoyt. And my sponsor was named Sarge, and he was real close to another guy they call Sarge here, and the three of them used to sit and argue sometimes. But they knew exactly how to stay sober, which is what I didn't know how to do. And then when I got sober, I found out I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to say what was appropriate. I didn't know how to act appropriate. I didn't know how to be a part of society. All I knew how to do was go to meetings, go to work, don't use, and don't drink. Go to meetings, go to work, don't use, and don't drink. Finally, after about a year, you know that, I got miserable. And it sucked being miserable and being sober. And, you know, started to say, well, it's time to start working some steps. And each and every one of those times I picked up, I was at a point, a turning point in my recovery, where there was time to make yet another change. And I was unwilling to do that. Now, I don't know about you alcoholics, but when I reach a point in my recovery where I'm unwilling to make an obvious change that needs to be made by use of these steps, use of the literature, and use of a sponsor, that I'm going to pick up again. Thinking that I'll just pick up a white chip, you know, tomorrow. Because that's the way it always goes for me. I know what to do. I just go get another white chip and start over. I don't have that mindset today. I don't ever want to have to start over again. When I came back here, before I moved away from Florida, I started getting sober again here. Triangle here in another club called the Clayton House, way down McDonough. And I was so fearful. And that's what I don't want to feel again. Because the motorcycle club I was with has never known me to pick back up. They don't know about any of the times I picked back up. And I was sitting right up there at Marriott, and I'd done all out. And I went and bought me a gallon of Bushmills and a shitload of Parks and Guinness and, you know, some other stuff. And it's sitting there in a pile on the table. And it was a pretty big pile of whatever. And I knew that that wasn't going to be enough. And then when I started in on it, I knew that I didn't want to live like that anymore. Because I knew that once I started, I probably wouldn't come back. And then I started, and I knew that I wasn't going to pick up another white chick. And then all of a sudden, I had some sort of moment. I guess I've heard it say the moments of clarity. I realized I was alone. I couldn't call my bike club because I was all screwed up. I had black shit all over my hands, and I had black shit in my heart, and black shit in my head. I was drunk, too drunk to drive. And I called another guy that they think is crazy as me around here. I'm not going to say his name, but he wouldn't care. He's a real good friend of mine. He came to get me. And I'll tell you, people, I don't want to ever feel that alone again. It wasn't about the drink, the drug, or what it does to me, or whether I was going to keep doing it, or what I had to do to get it. It was about, I don't want to ever feel that lonely again. And I'm real grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm real grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm real grateful to be sober today. And I'll close with this. If there's anybody out there, because we do have qualifications here at AA, and especially at NAVA because of our charter, and I'm a very proud member of NAVA. This probably saved my life. And if you're looking for a place to recover, and you might have done some outside things, but you're an alcoholic, you know, don't let some things that are set here run you off. All you got to do is get a sponsor and learn about what singleness of purpose is. And what that charter and what that sign means back there. And you can find a home right here at this NAVA club that facilitates Alcoholics Anonymous, but has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you're like me, you might need a place to hide someday, away from the people out there. Some place to sit and just meditate. Some place to go act like a kid amongst other adults that they think are kids. Some place to go where somebody will say some shit that will make you laugh when you hate every single thing about your life. And that's what the clubhouse has done for me. And the only way I can recognize that the clubhouse has done that for me is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two different entities. But if you think you need a place to recover, and all them other meetings they say, other fellowships they say you might need to be in, all you got to do is get a sponsor, get into the literature, find out what singleness of purpose is, and begin the journey to recover at Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't give a shit if you're addicted to anything. That's just for me. Thanks for watching.
Thank you, Bert. So in tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Donations support the group and AA is own. And I'm asking Owen Jones to give out the chips.
Yeah, Owen. I'm going on an alcoholic. Here we have a chip system to mark our progress in sobriety. If you have a desire to stop drinking tonight, you're up to your white shift. Does anybody have a desire to stop drinking? Or, you know, come on up. All right. We have a sober shift for 30 days. Anybody got 30 days? 90 days, a red shift. 6 months, yellow shift. 9 months, green. Anybody for a birthday? Thank God for the chips we hold.
Good job, thank you. It's time for AA-related announcements. Do we have any?
I'm Darrell. I'm Devin Schultz.
Hey, Darrell.
I need to say this more tonight. If I can get a couple of volunteers to help stack the chairs after me, I'd greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Sure that'll happen. Yes, sir.
Sunday night, Spencer, who a lot of you know here, is going to be speaking over at the Buckhead Cubs. That's 8 p.m. Sunday night.
8 p.m. Sunday, the Covenant, I mean it, the Covenant, Buckhead.
Yes.
Send the Boy Scout.
Yeah. Yeah, where is that on Peachtree?
It's near Peachtree Battle, about a block north.
He knows where it is.
Yes, tell us.
It's just north of Peachtree Battle's shopping center. If you are on Lindbergh Drive, coming down Lindbergh Drive, you take a left, and you'll come to Covenant Church on the corner on the left. And there's a very narrow driveway on the north side of the church, and the meeting is in the Scout Hut back of the parking lot. A very good meeting on Sunday night at 8 o'clock.
Good deal. And that's Spencer. Yes, Mark.
My name is Mark, and I'm an author. I have a teacher at the Literature Academy. If anyone likes any literature, send that to me.
Great. Yes, sir.
My name is Brennan, alcoholic. And I'm assuming under Alcoholics Anonymous meetings at NAB with the Clubhouse Facilitated Series 8 newcomers meeting right here in this room every Tuesday night. And it's been our conscious request and voted on that we keep our topics of discussion, recovery, on sponsorship, and first, second, and third step. So if you haven't worked those, you're not familiar with that. You've never seen nothing like this before in your entire life, and you want to start this journey, be sure to come out. It's at 8 o'clock. And if you've been around a while, and you hate your life, and you're miserable, half filling the blank, and you don't know what's wrong, you might need to be working with another alcoholic. And there's some new folks coming there that need somebody to work with. Take them through the steps, working the big book with them, filling some other literature. And start filling them out of rib once they put the drink down. That's just a symptom of our disease. And so it's at 8 o'clock every Tuesday night. Please come out and help us share the experience, strength, and hope of recovery from alcoholism. Thanks.
Thank you, Bert. Yes, Frank.
I'm Frank Waters. I'm a real alcoholic.
Yes, sir. Frank.
This Saturday, you never have a chance. Starts at 9:30. Elvis is going to be here. Elvis is already here. And we have a Thursday night dinner and a Saturday morning breakfast. Everybody's welcome whether you're a member or not. The doors are unlocked downstairs. If you decide to become a member of the club, you can see me after the meeting.
Thanks, Frank. And next Monday night, our scheduled speaker is Tom of Complete Abandon. Tom, as his friends know. So we're looking to get a confirmation on that in the next couple of days, but he's on the calendar. So we look forward to having Tom. Okay, I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever harmonious place principles, the four personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Hey, Darrell, would you take some, please?
big circle represent what we can do together, helping one another, to achieve the sobriety and the purpose of life that we're here for. Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep them happy, the works that you work at.